For the ones who work hard to ensure their crew can always go the extra mile, and the ones who get in early so everyone can go home on time, there's Grainger, offering professional-grade supplies backed by product experts so you can quickly and easily find what you need. Plus, you can count on access to a committed team ready to go the extra mile for you. Call, click Grainger.com, or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
We all know that vitamins can help fill nutritional gaps in our diet, but a lot of us don't like to take vitamins because we don't like swallowing pills. How do you feel about that, Janet?
There's some days that I look at my vitamins and go, yeah, I should take those. I'll do it later. But I'll tell you what's changed. I have gotten Easy Melt vitamins. I have the D3 and I have the B12s and a multivitamin, and I just pop them in my mouth and they dissolve and I don't have to think about swallowing a vitamin.
Yeah, and you don't necessarily need water either to have on hand to get this big vitamin now.
Yeah, no, and they taste good and they're sugar-free. They melt quickly. The reason they melt is because of plants. Not chemicals.
Plant-based nutrition. For a limited time only, you can receive a free 3-month supply of Easy Melt vitamin D3 with your first purchase. To claim your free D3, visit try.easymelt.com/onboys. That's try.easymelts. EZMELTS.com/onboys.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
There is much to be learned from the wisdom and wonder of a small child when we slow down to take time to observe it. Teacher Tom shares with us how to do that and why it's so important. This is the On Boys Parenting Podcast. We are your co-hosts, Jennifer L.W. Fink of buildingboys.net, and I'm Janet Allison of boysalive.com. As always, thank you for being here, and thank you for supporting our sponsors. The innate curiosity and wisdom of a young child seems almost magical at times. I've learned that all over again as I've watched my new grandson grow. Our guest today is masterful in interpreting the young child, showing us how to love and support each unique being, and also encouraging us adults to give young ones the space to grow while we step back and observe how their development unfolds in a natural way through play. Teacher Tom, a retired preschool teacher, a dad, and educational consultant, returns to our podcast. And Tom, we are so happy to have you back.
Oh, well, thank you for inviting me back, Janet. And Jen, it's really a pleasure to spend some time with you.
So you were a preschool teacher for almost 20 years. And I'm curious, over that span of time, how did kids change? And maybe I should also ask, how did parents change?
Well, I can say kids didn't change at all over that time. Parents did change. They changed, you know, it's odd how this works. They got younger and younger.
What is with that? I'm experiencing that.
When I first started teaching, the parents were, I would consider my peers age-wise. And by the time I, you know, left, they were young enough to be my kids.
Did you ever have the child of one of your students, or were you not quite there that long?
Didn't quite get there that long. I have kids. I have some of my students who are college graduates now, but not yet having their own babies, as far as I know.
So what changes did you notice in the parents and, you know, kids? I think I agree with you. Kids are kids. But kids pick up on parent and adult stuff too.
I would say that the main change that I saw in the adults is just mainly the changes that we see throughout society. I mean, to me, it was there was a heightened concern about safety, a heightened concern about academics, a heightened concern about just their children and how they're going to do in the world. So I do think it was very clear to me that the pressures on parents have increased and continue to increase, I think, over the course of the last probably 20 years or so. I think there's more fear out there, and there's more fear of their child falling behind. Now, the kids aren't worried about this stuff, right? And I know that, you know, there is research out there that says that children are experiencing stress and anxiety at levels that we have never seen before. You know, my friend Peter Gray, who is a researcher but is talking about other people's research, says, and this is a real change. This is kind of research we've been doing since the 50s, and we've never seen three-year-olds with this, you know, kind of stress and anxiety. So children are obviously changing in that regard. I don't know if that's true of society overall. Maybe we're all more anxious. And it's interesting, though, that apparently from some of the stuff that I've been looking at, COVID actually reduced anxiety and stress amongst children, but it increased it amongst adults.
Yeah, given whatever their home circumstances and less, you know, less running around, less
interaction. Right. Well, when we're talking research, we're not talking about individuals, right? Because each individual had a overall different experience. But in this case, I think there were a lot of kids who were experiencing relief not having to go to school, experiencing relief to stay home with their parents. In some cases, I know that there are examples of parents who were able to work it out. And like one of the parents has never gone back to work. They're continuing to either homeschool or chose to become entrepreneurs or to work for themselves or to become artists or something else that allowed them the flexibility to have their children with them during the day. And that was a positive thing. I know that, you know, and people are going to listen to this and say, well, what about the stress? Yeah, some kids had a horrible time and are still having a horrible time, and we need to think about them. But I, you know, I can't say that there's any generic change in the children, but I do think the parents, just like all of us, the world has changed. And so we adapt. That's what humans do. And they're working to adapt to the changed environment. But at the same time, the kids still need the same things, right? They still need freedom to play. They need to follow their own curiosity. They need to learn how to ask and answer their own questions, or they're driven to. It's not that they need to, they're driven to answer, ask and answer their own questions, to follow their curiosity, and to learn how to get along with the other people.
Basically, you're describing play-based learning. So for our listeners, define play-based learning. Let's start there.
Well, I mean, play-based learning is the theory that we are designed as animals. We are born with the capacity to learn for ourselves. We're designed, and that play is that urge, that instinct to learn made manifest. Play is the way we, I guess the way I always look at it is that when we look at the way the human brain works, we're designed to notice novelty, to notice things that are different. And the first question always in the evolutionary brain is, can it kill me or hurt me? And then the answer is fight or flight, right? But then the second question is, you know, what can I do with this?
Right?
Can I eat it? Can I play with it? Can I build something with it? Can I create with it? And what we see is, you know, once children have the, you know, get over their fear response over something, that's what they naturally do. And we call that play. Mm-hmm. As they get older, we start calling it self-directed learning. And what I like to point out is like most people, I think, agree that up until about the age 5, children should mostly be learning through play. I mean, there are people who disagree with that, but mostly I think we all agree that. And then I think most of us agree that once we're out of school, learning should be self-directed. That, you know, if you want to learn how to do something, you find a YouTube video, or you come on and you look at a podcast like On Boys, or you do something like that to educate yourself. You read a book, you go take a class, you self-motivate yourself to go do it. But for some reason, we have this idea, really bizarre idea, that between the ages of 5 and 18, or maybe, you know, go through college, that learning has to be hard. Learning has to be involved with sitting in a classroom, having an adult tell you what to learn and how to learn and when to learn and how to hold your body while you're learning and whether to move or not while you're learning, all of these kinds of things. So to me, that's a really artificial way to learn. And so for me, you know, play-based learning to me is when people get to make their own choices about what they're going to learn and how they're going to learn it. And young children are the masters of it.
You know, one of the things that I think has helped me and did help me accept kids' innate curiosity and them exploring at their own pace and nurturing and exploring that. If you ever watch a nature documentary, approach your kids the same way. It's really similar. I mean, obviously, humans are different than other animals. There's lots of differences, but there's lots of similarities. You approach something and you try and figure it out. Kids do that. And I frankly find it enjoyable to watch. I think a lot of us do. And then I think we run into trouble often because kids, as you know, better than so many, they are on their own schedule and their own timetable. And these artificial clocks and calendars of ours don't mean anything to a preschool child. And so it can be very hard as adults who are living in the society that demands so much of us to create spaces and room for kids to explore at their own speed.
Mm-hmm. Are you familiar with the work of Alison Gopnik? Mm-hmm. She's retired now. She's a psychologist and a researcher. I think she worked at Berkeley for most of her career. And one of her books is called The Gardener and the Carpenter. Maybe it's the Carpenter and the Gardener, something like that. And one of the things I loved about this book is she said, you know, when she was preparing this book, she did what they call a Nexus search, which was the academic version of a Google search. So it's a little more, it goes into academic kind of things. And she was looking for the word parenting.
Okay.
Right. And this is a word we use all the time. And mm-hmm. we talk about parenting. I think the subtitle to this podcast is parenting. So it has the word parenting in it. And I use the word parenting all the time. She said that shockingly, before about 1962, the word was almost not used at all. Oh. There was virtually no use of the word parenting. And then since then, it's gone up like exponentially, right? That the term parenting has gone crazy. And she points out, she says, and to her, she thought that was significant because she believes, she says, you know, what happened somehow is we went from this idea that being a parent is a relationship we have with another person to parenting. We turned it into a verb.
It's a thing we do.
It's a thing we do to somebody or with somebody. I mean, and then she says she made this great thing. She said, you don't do wifing. Mm-hmm. You don't do husbanding. All other foundational you don't do friending, except maybe on Facebook. You
know, brothering.
All of the other relations, you don't do cousining or uncling or any of that kind of stuff. And she says, you know, this is where we really, in her idea, this is where we kind of lost our way. Is we suddenly created this idea that, because her metaphor is, if you're parenting, then you're like a carpenter.
Yeah.
You've got the job. You got to build a table. You know, and at the end, people are going to judge you by that table. Is it level? Is it big enough? Or does it have four legs? Is it wobbly? What did you make it out of? All this kind of stuff. And you're going to get judged by that.
And I know so many parents feel that. I mean, we feel like we are judged constantly based on our child's behavior. Now, perhaps we are. There is some truth to that. I mean, you go to the grocery store, your kid's the one throwing a fit. You know there are people judging you.
They're judging you. That's right.
But that's not really at all an accurate representation of what we should be doing or how we should be approaching this, is it?
I mean, and then the other side of that metaphor of Gopnik's is the gardener. Mm-hmm. That really that relationship is more about, should be more along the lines of being a gardener. Our job is, you know, the seeds in the ground. Our job is to make sure it's protected, make sure it gets enough water, enough sun. But otherwise, it's the seed's job to do the growing.
Yes.
And that's to me, I find that metaphor so powerful, both as an educator and as a parent, being able to do that. I mean, you mentioned that idea of your kid having a tantrum in the grocery store, and you're right. There are people out there judging you. They're judging you for what's going on. And here's your child. Doing their best idea. This is the best thing they have going. They're upset. Their lids flipped. And our job is not to sit there and scold them into it, not to punish them like, you know, you stop doing that, young lady, you're embarrassing me, or you don't, you know, try to bribe them with a reward to have them stop. You let them experience their emotion the way a seed, you know, is going to branch off this way, or fruit or leaf, or do the things that a plant does. And I understand it might be disturbing to the other people to have a child cry. Maybe we walk outside and say, let's go outside to the car so, you know, we're not bothering the other people. But that emotion isn't yours. It's that child's. And I think that's one of the great pressures on parents right now. And it upsets me so much, is that we are supposed to control our children so much that we're even responsible for controlling their feelings.
Yes.
And we're judged because your child has a feeling. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really out of control. I mean, I could go on and on about why I think this is, but the truth is that I think we put a lot of pressure on parents. I think a lot of it has to do with the breakdown of kind of our villages and our communities. The fact that, you know, families often feel like they're all on their own, this little isolated little unit, their own parents, the grandparents, they're nowhere near. Mm-hmm. Right. They're mm-hmm. thousands of miles away. So, you know, you have to, I don't know, Janet, if you're close to your grandchild.
I am. But
you are.
So I am lucky enough to be close.
A deliberate yeah. choice. And deliberate one you were able choice. To make. Not everybody yes. can make that choice.
And exactly. Not everybody can make
important.
It.
Important.
And but the yeah. truth is that historically, grandparents, humans evolved grandparents because human children, one of the things that makes them different, Jen, it makes us different. Our babies, they need us for an extended period of time. You know, most other
do
animals.
I know.
As mom of four, do you know?
Minimum of 10 years, if not longer, in order to like get out there in the world and survive. And one parent can't do it. Two parents can't do it. You need a village. You need the grandmas and grandpas. Yeah. You need the extended family, the aunts and the uncles and all of this kind of stuff. And to me, that's, I think Kurt Vonnegut, one of the things he wrote in his last memoirs was that if he wished anything for the world is that everybody had an extended family.
Yeah. 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 Well, and I saw on Instagram that the best parent hack is to have a grandparent living close by. Mm-hmm. And it's true. My daughter said this weekend, like, I couldn't have done this year without you, Mom. And of course, that made me tear up a little bit, but it's true. It's so true. And so if you don't have that healthy grandparent figure, then you got to find it. And right. it can be a neighbor, it can be somebody, mm-hmm. but you don't have to go this alone.
You know who is a really weak replacement for grandmas? Teacher Tom. You know, coming to like us experts online and stuff like that. I mean, that's why all of us make a living doing this. That's why mm-hmm. we're in demand, is because, you know, that's why that bookstores are, you know, the bookstores yeah. that are still left have huge parenting sections. Mm-hmm. And there's, you know, you go on Amazon and that's some of the best-selling books are parent related books. And they all mm-hmm. say different things, by the way. They're all different, just the way grandmas are all different and grandpas yep. are all different.
Yeah,
true.
We are going to pause for a message from our sponsors. When we come back, Teacher Tom will be talking about the emotional arc.
I like cute clothes. I like having stylish outfits, and I hate shopping. Armoire makes getting dressed easier. Armoire is a clothing rental membership option. And Janet and I recently have both tried it out, and you guys, it is so much fun. You go to their website, you get to take a little quick style quiz, takes 5 minutes, and then you get presented a list of beautiful clothing, pictures, wonderful clothes that you can pick out and get delivered to your house for you to try and wear in the comfort of your own home without going out, and determine what looks cute, put together outfits without investing a ton of money. Right now, our listeners can give Armoire a try and get up to 50% off your first month. That is up to $125 off. Just visit armoire.style/onboys. That's armoire.style, armoire.style/onboys to get 50% off your first month and never have to worry about what to wear again. Try Armoire today. One of the most challenging things about being a woman at midlife is realizing how little people understand about perimenopause and menopause, Janet. I just had a conversation with my sister about that this weekend. She is 10 years younger than me, so I'm 51, she's 41, and she went to ask her healthcare provider, hey, can you provide me some information? And she got information, but she was frustrated by how incomplete it seems, how little we know, and how for way too many people, the answer seems to be, yep, that's the way it is. Deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Deal with it. And not only are our mamas out there having to deal with perimenopause, likely at this age, but many of our moms are dealing with their sons entering or in puberty, which is kind of nature's irony, which is, oof.
Cruel joke, it's- Janet. Cruel joke.
Cruel joke.
Thankfully, increasingly, there are those who are recognizing that women need and deserve competent care and treatment for perimenopause and menopausal symptoms. And we know that can still be harder to access than it should be, which is why we have partnered with Winona. Winona helps women who are dealing with menopause or perimenopause. Winona is a collection of OBGYN health professionals who believe that your symptoms are important, real, and deserve to be taken seriously. It's telehealth. You can access care from your home when it is convenient for you.
Visit buywinona.com today to start your free visit. With free U.S. shipping and the ability to pause or cancel at any time, your path to wellness has zero obligations. Use the code ONBOYS at buywinona.com for 25% off your first order. That's buywinona.com/onboys. Winona, menopause care made easy.
I want to circle back to something you were talking about, because you talked about this on the last time you were on the podcast with us. And I've used it so many times, and I think it bears repeating, and you sort of alluded to it. And that is the emotional arc. Mm-hmm. Will you tell us about the emotional arc? And you had a story about your daughter.
It's the story I've told many times, and I forget how often I've told it. But, you know, sometimes repeating things is the way people remember things. So I'll be happy to do that. So to me, the story I think you're referring to is, at one point, my daughter she was 4 years old or something, and she came home from school and she was upset about a friend who had rejected her. You know, there was this one little girl in particular. She was in love with this girl, and the little girl, nothing wrong. The girl was not a bully or anything. Just let me be clear. This little girl was a perfectly normal little girl, somewhat introverted, and didn't really like the idea that my daughter would run over to her and put her face in her face and say, "Will you play with me? Will you play with me?" Right. So the response was not, unexpected from my point of view, but she was really upset because this had happened several days and this little girl didn't want to play with her. And she was in her room crying, and I'm, you know, trying to be a good dad, do some parenting. And I'm sitting there beside the bed, and I was saying, trying to give her some strategy or some philosophy or some ideas for what she could do to, you know, make things better, or ways to hold it, way to think about it. And she pulled herself together enough to look at me and just say, "Papa, I have to finish my cry. I want you to leave now."
And
and I walked out of the room, and, you know, and later I told my wife about this, and Jennifer, my wife, she said, "You know, I want you to do that with me too. Sometimes you just have to finish your cry." And what I've really come to understand is that, you know, for our emotions, like a child having an emotion in a grocery store we were talking about before, it's emotions have this natural arc, this natural beginning, middle, and end to them. And so often what we do is we see a child starting to experience an emotion, and out of probably the best intentions, we jump in there with this idea, okay, well, we have to fix this emotion, right? This is part of that parenting paradigm,
feeling like we need to control our children's emotions, right? Yeah. Our child is sad. This clearly must reflect badly on us. Also, my child is in distress. This makes me uncomfortable. I must change this.
Right. Mm-hmm. And so that's exactly what happens. And so what we do is we interrupt that arc. So often, because we threaten a punishment, or we offer a reward, or we say things like, you know, there's nothing to cry about. Mm-hmm. Or we say things like, it's okay, you're going to be okay, and all this stuff. And the truth is what we do is we interrupt that. Or if she had adopted, like if I had succeeded in getting her to listen to my philosophies and all that kind of stuff about what she should do, she never would have discovered that, hey, I can come out on the other side and be okay. I get to feel that full arc of that emotion and come out on the other side. It really comes back to being the gardener, right? Mm-hmm. Being the one who's just letting the seed grow, letting the seed have its experience. And I'm there. I'm there for you, whatever you need for me. But that's all I can do is be there with you.
Mm-hmm. So I think this is super important, especially right now. Janet, you know, Teacher Tom, sure you know, there's been a lot of conversation lately, a lot of concern about youth mental health. You referred to it at the beginning, you know, teens reporting massive increases in depression, sadness, anxiety. And a lot of well-meaning parents, educators, and adults are extremely concerned about this, and rightfully so. Mm-hmm. And rightfully so. Yeah. I do think that there's some danger then in thinking we have to fix this and fix it in a way that doesn't mean tending to the garden. Because from my perspective, tending to the garden means nurturing the things that kids, humans, need to thrive. Mm-hmm. Safety, space, comfort, recognition, time to process their emotions and to learn they can come out on the other side. I'd love to hear some of your thoughts on that. You know, obviously what happens with our young children affects them when they're older, and we can't necessarily go back and reparent, but how does this all link together for you?
Well, I mean, I think the first thing I would say is one of the things parents have come to me about over the years and been concerned. They said, I'm worried that my child's going to end up in therapy. And my first response is good, right? That's a sign of mental health that you know you need help. That tells me that your child has grown up understanding that I'm not in this alone and that I can seek out somebody who's going to help me out. So that, first of all, I think that stigma is really a big one. And I think overall, the stigma about mental health is really, and, you know, since I'm on the On Boys podcast here, I will say, I think that we've done a lot of harm to our males in general, because, you know, as for the most part, we grow up with this belief that we're only allowed like one emotion, right? We're allowed anger.
Yep.
That's okay. If you're a man, if you're a girl and express anger, there's something wrong with you. But, you know, the boys, we can have anger, but we can't have sadness.
No. Nope.
Right. That's embarrassing if you're crying, or, you know, you can't have fear. You can't be afraid of anything. So we learn to rely on that secondary emotion of anger. But I see, you know, when I look around at the world beyond just young children, I see we have a very angry society right now. We have people feeling very upset and angry. So I would hate to just blame social media or blame the media or blame politicians or blame anybody like that. I think it's all of us have kind of created this environment where people, I honestly think we feel trapped. And when I look at young children, I feel like very often the ones who are in more academic style settings where they have to walk in lines and raise their hands and study, do worksheets and study whatever the teacher tells them to study, even if they're not interested in what the weather today is, they still have to talk about the weather today. I think they start to feel like they're in a cage. And what we do naturally when we're in a cage is we look for escapes. We look for ways out. Right now, one of the few places that where kids still have some level of freedom is online.
Yep.
Right. When you talk about teenagers, everybody's complaining about them, you know, on their phones all the time and everything. And I'll say, yeah, I mean, there are lots of negatives to being on your phone all the time, but that's the only place where they're truly free. It's one of the few places where they have this. And what's the first thing that teachers are doing to kids when they get to middle school and high school? They take away their phones. So now they've taken away the last vestige of freedom.
Well, for boys, video games very much has played that role. You know, in a video game, I have freedom of movement. I have freedom to try things, to do things in a way that I don't necessarily in the real world. And I am not saying that video games are the solution. I am saying that I think it's helpful for adults to recognize that this may be some of the attraction for children. And I've long thought that, you know, maybe if we can increase children's freedom in the rest of the world, it would be more attractive for them.
I agree with you completely. I think that's my point. I mean, sometimes when I make this comment about the phones, people think I'm saying cell phones are good. I'm not saying they're good or bad. They're tools. They're tools. And, you know, just like I'm not going to say alcohol's bad, but for some people, the cage they're in makes them use it too much. For some people, you know, I'm not going to say any of the stuff's bad, you know, sugar, high fat foods, all that kind of stuff, unhealthy eating and all that stuff becomes people's escape. So I think that focus on mental health overall is really important. And we can start really early with the early years when we start working with young children. And we understand that those first 5 years shouldn't be about learning your phonics. They shouldn't be about learning how to do math. They should be about learning how to live with this complicated thing called emotions, this amazing thing that gives us all these emotions. And in fact, you know, there's many neuroscientists now who are saying our minds, the consciousness, the thing that makes us uniquely human, comes directly from our emotions. It's sourced from our emotions. It's not our emotions are not a byproduct. Or they don't get in the way. We can't think rationally without experiencing these emotions and understanding them. And so the more I look into this, the more the research is being done. And, you know, and I love nothing more than to read neuroscience, and I can't read the, I can't read the latest stuff because I'm not smart enough, but I read it once it becomes popularized and somebody mm-hmm. writes a book about it. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and we're always 10 years behind what they're doing in the laboratories, but I find myself constantly just amazed by this idea that people are starting to say, you know what, maybe we even made a mistake saying that our minds come out of our brains. Our minds are actually might be sourced from our entire bodies.
Mm-hmm. So then our gut. Thinking,
mm-hmm. how are we telling kids to sit still? They need to be moving their bodies, putting their hands on things.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, learning often starts with a sensory experience, right? When a child burns themselves on a fire or on a candle, that's where the learning about fire and candles start, yeah. right? No matter how much you've scolded them, if that thing has an allure to them, when you turn your back, they're going to put their finger in it.
And they'll only do that once.
And they'll only do it once.
They'll only do it once. I mean, this year, I do go on about my grandson, but it yeah. has been amazing to have the time and space to watch him do the things that you're talking about. And just, you know, at his birthday party, one helium balloon, he learned so much about physics, sitting there letting the balloon go up and hitting the ceiling and pulling it back down again. You know, just the magic and wonder and awe in his eyes. And that was probably 10 minutes of his party going on around him, but he and I just sat there with that balloon, and you could just see his mind just working, and mm-hmm. and also the joy of learning and experiencing and seeing something new. And I mm-hmm. think that's what you're saying about this emotional piece of the joy of experiencing. And it's not always joy, because he did almost put his finger in his candle and mm-hmm. almost had that lesson on that day too.
On his first birthday.
And he'll have it at some point. Just having that space and being able to observe and allow our children, and not be the hovering helicopter parenting that we hear so much about.
Well, Janet, what I hear you talking about is makes my heart sink, because it's you're talking about the highest activity we can do with children. Yeah, we keep them safe and we keep them nurtured and fed and all that stuff, but just observing them mm-hmm. and letting ourselves be awed.
Yeah.
By what they're doing, and to think, why is, you know, what is that baby looking at? We don't have to be constantly in their faces with books and in their
colors
ears with
music
and in colors and training them all the time. It's much better. It's just to let them lie on their backs and experience the world mm-hmm. and us being there with them.
Do you know if there is research on how doing that benefits us as adults? And I don't know if there is, you know, you mentioned neuroscience, and certainly it's good for the infant, for the child. I'm thinking it's got to be good for us too.
Mirror neurons. But I will tell you, in my own personal experience, it makes you slow down. And it also makes, like, all the other things of life go away when you're yep. in that place, just focused on that child. It renews that awe and wonder for your mm-hmm. for yourself. And that's calming, soothing to the nervous system, and relaxing and joy-filled. I want to switch and ask you about this, because I'm a family coach, and this question comes up from parents occasionally.
After these brief messages from our sponsors, we are going to be talking about gender. This episode is sponsored by ByHeart.
Babies need to eat. And whether you breastfeed or bottle feed, use formula, combine all of the above, you need options. We wanted to let you know about ByHeart baby formula. ByHeart has a patented protein blend that gets the closest to breast milk. It includes two of the most abundant proteins in breast milk. And ByHeart actually ran a clinical trial comparing their formula to a leading infant formula, and proved that babies on ByHeart have softer poops, less spit up, and easier digestion. ByHeart is also the only US-made infant formula to use organic, grass-fed whole milk. So if you need baby formula for your baby, consider ByHeart. New customers can get 10% off your first order by using code ONBOYS at ByHeart.com. That's BYHEART.com buyheart.com/podcast, and it is 10% off your first order. buyheart.com/podcast. This is a limited time offer, and additional terms and conditions may apply. One of the most challenging things about being a woman at midlife is realizing how little people understand about perimenopause and menopause, Janet. I just had a conversation with my sister about that this weekend. She is 10 years younger than me, so I'm 51, she's 41, and she went to ask her healthcare provider, hey, can you provide me some information? And she got information, but she was frustrated by how incomplete it seems, how little we know, and how for way too many people, the answer seems to be, yep, that's the way it is. Deal with it.
Mm-hmm. Deal with it. And not only are our mamas out there having to deal with perimenopause likely at this age, but many of our moms are dealing with their sons entering or in puberty, which is kind of nature's irony, which is, oof.
Cruel joke, Janet. Cruel joke.
Cruel joke.
Thankfully, increasingly, there are those who are recognizing that women need and deserve competent care and treatment for perimenopause and menopausal symptoms. And we know that can still be harder to access than it should be, which is why we have partnered with Winona. Winona helps women who are dealing with menopause or perimenopause. Winona is a collection of OBGYN health professionals who believe that your symptoms are important, real, and deserve to be taken seriously. It's telehealth. You can access care from your home when it is convenient for you.
Visit buywinona.com today to start your free visit. With free U.S. shipping and the ability to pause or cancel at any time, your path to wellness has zero obligations. Use the code ONBOYS at buywinona.com for 25% off your first order. That's buywinona.com/ONBOYS. Winona, menopause care made easy. I'm guessing maybe 20 years ago, this probably didn't come up for you. It certainly didn't come up for me very often. But now it's this question around gender mm-hmm. questioning, gender confusion. And here's the boy that wants to wear dresses. And mm-hmm. does the parent let them because they might be made fun of at school? And I mean, we're still in that place, that transitional place of, is it okay for boys to wear fingernail polish and dresses? Still there. What are your thoughts?
These are young children. These are, you know, what we're talking, at least I've always worked with preschoolers, right? Mm-hmm. And so I'm going to speak from my area of expertise.
Yep.
Children will dress up in a monkey costume, you know, to explore what a monkey's all about. They'll dress up as a princess to see what a princess is all about. And it doesn't matter what biological gender that child, you know, we think they are.
Doesn't matter what species they are.
What species they are. They're just, what they're doing is trying to learn about their world through their what we call dramatic play, which, or imaginative play or imaginary play or whatever we want to pretend play, all those words like that. But what they're doing, I mean, I this is fascinating to me because what you're saying, about, I guess, 7 or 8 years ago, I wrote a blog post about a little boy, 3-year-old boy, who really looked up to his older sister. And I knew his older sister, and he thought she was the coolest thing in the world. One day he showed up wearing one of her dresses, and she was at school with him that day. So it was one of those days we had this glamorous older girl there. And I could see, you know, normally he was this bold kid, but this day you could see he was prepared, right? Three. He already knew that what he was doing was a little bit different and that it might set himself up for, maybe his sister had warned him. I mean, that could have been like, if you wear that, people are going to tease you. Or his parents may have said it, but I'm guessing it was probably his sister because the parents probably didn't say a word because he came in different costumes every day. But he came in this day and he was very reticent. But, you know, as the day went on, he went ahead and had his experience. And I was really impressed by his courage because, you know, I could see that he was like, almost like that sweaty nervousness, like you're worried, waiting for the other shoe to drop. But it went okay with him. You know, nobody even remarked on it, right? Because young children really, you know, they're still trying to figure out.
They're pretty self-centered.
They're pretty self-centered.
Appropriately so. That's developmentally appropriate.
And they're not really into like teasing one another. They don't get the power of teasing somebody when you're really young. That's something you learn as you get older, probably after you've been teased. So just yesterday morning, I didn't have time to write a brand new blog post. So I refreshed that one and put that online. And all of a sudden, there were adults. This did never happen 7 years ago. There were adults like, "Oh, you're, you know, this is horrible of you to do this. This is terrible. What are you, your agenda?" And I'm like, nothing's changed. Yeah. Nothing's changed, but the adults' attitudes about this, the adult perceptions about this. When I was a boy, I know that I wore my mother's high heels sometimes. Mm-hmm. I would go in her closet because that's pretty cool.
My brothers pulled on my mom's pantyhose because she would like rinse it out in the bathroom and she'd hang it to dry in the shower, and they're taking a bath and they're like, "Wonder what I can do with that." Exactly what you said. "Wonder what I can do with."
And I felt like what he was doing, in fact, what he told me later in that, and I wrote this in the blog post, he made some comment about, "Well, I'm a mommy." I said something about being a girl or something like, not about him being a girl, but about gender. And he said, "Well, I'm a mommy." And then he held a baby up to his breast as if he was breastfeeding it. Now, this was, to me, this tells me he was trying to understand what mommy means. Mm. He was trying to experience what that might be like to be a mommy. And his own mother was not in the stage. They didn't have a baby at home. So this was something he'd seen in the outside world. He'd seen other parents or something. And he was exploring this. I had assumed he was trying to emulate his older sister. And maybe to a degree he was. But he was actually exploring something that's like, mommy, that's a big issue to explore. And part of the way he did it was to embody it.
This is so interesting to me because I've never thought of it this way before, but you're right. It's trying to learn by embodying it, by like getting into it as much as you can and really trying to experience the world through somebody else's, their costume, their, how they present, how they're treated, which is a super high form of like empathy and learning to me. On the one hand, we have so many, and I'll speak as a woman because that's what I am. We have so many women who wish that the men in their lives, if only you knew what it was like to be a woman, you know, you would have more empathy for what I'm going through. We say this about our spouses, partners, other men in the world. And at the same time, we're denigrating and shaming children who are actively doing this. That makes no sense.
It's craziness to me. The children are not, and nothing they do at this age has anything to do with their future in a way, right? It's not like if a little boy is playing guns, right, and pretending to shoot some ass, it doesn't mean he's going to grow up to be a mass murderer. In fact, it's probably, I've seen research that shows if you're allowed to play those games when you're young, you're less likely to be violent when you grow up. We have to understand that on the one hand, we take it way too seriously, everything. The other hand, maybe we don't take it seriously enough, right? That play is super serious, but the specifics of that play is just, you know, today he's going to wear a dress. The next day he's going to wear, a Darth Vader costume.
We are, as parents, so concerned about our kids' future. You alluded to that before, right? We have this anxiety because we want them to turn out, quote unquote, good. We want them to be decent people. We don't want them to get in trouble. We don't want them to make trouble for others. So we watch every little thing for a sign that something's going wrong so we can put them back on the track. Right. And what you are underscoring is something that I only know in hindsight, because I didn't know this before I raised kids, right? So much of what happens is fleeting.
Yeah.
Kids have interest. They try it, they discard it. They try it, they discard it. Only in hindsight will you be able to look back and notice a couple through threads.
Right.
You know, there are certain things that stick with kids from very early on to later. My oldest now, he's 25. He's a singer, dancer, performer. I can look all the way back to when he was 3 and 4. Mm-hmm. And that was a consistent thread that kept popping up. I had other kids, other boys in the same household who tried on the same dance costumes, which, by the way, were dance costumes from when I was a kid. So we're talking girl dance costumes, tried them on. They didn't become dancers. That's not their thing.
Right.
So parents, try and relax a little bit. No. Like try and just enjoy some of the fun. If something keeps popping up over years, that's different.
It's different. Well, and also you said the important thing, as long as you're not harming other people,
Yeah.
And as long as they're not harming themselves, and, you know, I suppose you can draw the line, well, if they do this, then they might get teased or something like that. Well, we've all been teased. It's part of the natural habitat of human beings, is that there's a certain amount of teasing, and being able to handle that is an important skill to have in life, is to be able to laugh at yourself.
Yeah. Right?
Which is what I think young children really learn in the early years when they do that, is they learn, you know, they learn to have fun being different and challenging and trying new things.
Talk a little bit about children and their social interactions. I think there's a place where we as adults try to manage that, you know, mm-hmm. Oh, you need to share, be gentle, that, you know, that place where, again, we're parenting or we're teaching over them. Talk about children, young children, and their social learning. Yeah.
Well, I mean, it's, you know, obviously this is, it's some children, they walk into my classrooms and they, from day one, they're just like buddies, right? They come, even the 2-year-olds will come in, you know, people tell you all the time, oh, 2-year-olds only do parallel play. That's not true. Some of them come in and they're already ready to just like make buddies with people and make friends. And then there's others who, even at 5-year-old, are still a little bit more like they want to play by myself. And they're a little bit, you can put it into the categories that Carl Jung came up with, you know, introvert, extrovert. Mm-hmm. And I think these are traits that change over time and in situations, but that's okay. But they're experiencing that at one time or another. So I think one of the prejudices we have is that we all want that kid who just comes in the room and says, I'm here, play with me. Woohoo. You know, mm-hmm. we have this prejudice and we're a little bit concerned if our child stands back and is cautious. I've always said that, you know, taking time to observe what's going on, your child is probably safer that way. It gives them a chance to really see what's happening. The kid who dives right in is more likely to get hurt physically and emotionally. But what I really like to point out is that, to me, you know, our job, as we've talked about many times already, is, you know, keeping them safe, right? Safety is job one. And I think being realistic about what safety means. It's like we can all have catastrophic imaginations. I can imagine that right now there's a jet engine falling on Janet's head. Mm-hmm. You better duck, you know, because it might fall through your roof.
I'm going to laugh if that happens, and that will be so inappropriate.
Well, it would be, please don't happen. Please don't happen.
Wait, I hear a loud noise.
Duck. But being realistic about, you know, what are the, you know, and I find myself asking myself this all the time when I'm working with young children, what is the worst thing that could happen here? And then work back from there. And what are the odds of that happening? Okay, so they might scrape their knee because they're running on the asphalt.
I'm not too
worried about that. If there's mm-hmm. worries about like head injuries and eye injuries, then I get concerned, right? Because those things might not heal, but it's scrapes or, you know, and then you got the broken bone that's in between, you know, what do? You know, how do you play that game? But so, you know, that's our first job, right? Is that safety piece, but the social emotional safety part too. I mean, this is something that we have, it's a tough balance. You have to know your kid. You have to know the environment they're going into. But I think that too often, we have a tendency to step in too soon. I have this rule of 15s that I use in the classroom. And it, you know, I share this with other educators all the time, is that in any new play environment, when the kids show up, the first 15 minutes usually are very peaceful. The kids come in, they there's the toys, the materials they have to interact with. They explore them. They all individually, usually they each take time to figure out what's here. And then after about 15 minutes, that's when they might need us, right? That's when they start bumping up against each other. That's when they start doing things like, you know, hey, you knocked over my building, or you took all of them and I want some of them, or, you know, you're in my space, and they start bickering. And that's when we so often come in and we do the adult thing, right? Where we come in and mm-hmm. say, okay, everybody gets 3 reds and 3 blues, and, you know, or you get 5 minutes, I'll keep track of the time, and then you get 5 minutes. And we come in with these adult created solutions. Well, what we do though, is we rob them of the chance to learn that basic skill of self-governance. Mm-hmm. Of self-control, of actually saying, okay, we've got a problem here, and the voice is raised. That's what worries us. We're worried about the loud voices. The loud voices don't hurt people, especially if it's equal. So what I'd like to do is that bickering is an essential part. It's called negotiating, mm-hmm. right? It's called living with the other people. And the reason we put up with that, you know, because people all the time, they say play-based learning, when they imagine play, they think about joy and laughing and stuff. There's always bickering going on when children are playing. Always bickering. It's
parents,
essential.
Please listen. If you have more than one child, bickering is normal. It's completely, totally, 100% normal. It does not mean you're a bad parent. It does not mean your kids are bad kids. It means they're humans trying to figure out how to get along with humans.
Yeah. And then the reason we put up with that is to get to the beautiful part. Because then once they get over, it's about half an hour in to any play. That's when they start having their ideas. Hey, let's put our buildings together and make one big building. Hey, I've got an idea. How about, you know, I have my turn and you have your turn. They start coming up with their own ideas now. And what's beautiful about sometimes, you know, the kids come up with solutions that as adults we think are silly, stupid. Like, let's all wear this costume at the same time. And they so much fun trying to figure out how they can all have a piece of the costume on them. Or let's all carry this box over. And you have 10 kids around a box trying to carry it somewhere. It's and they're giggling and laughing as they do it. That's how we learn to get along. So that's why in any play environment, anytime kids are playing, you need to wait at least 45 minutes, if not an hour, before they actually settle into it and start engaging with that. And that's one of the challenges that we have in our schools is we have all these schedules, right? We have this, you know, as soon as they start getting engaged with something, then it's like, oh, time for something else. And then we have this transition issue, right? Everybody's like upset because nobody likes transitions. I don't like transitions.
Me neither.
Like transitions. Every Monday morning, I love my work, but Monday morning is a transition. It's like, I wish I had one more day of the weekend. We all have that. I want to stay in bed. I don't want to leave the house. You know, all of these kinds of things. And so what we can do is give, you talked about it earlier, Jen, about the time.
Yeah.
The sweep of time in order to engage and to fully explore what's happening and your feelings about it. So anyway, so to me, that's, when I talk about the social aspects, to me, it really is a lot about giving children the opportunity to have that bickering, to have those uncomfortable moments. And they're mostly uncomfortable for us, to be honest. And, you know, and the children, you know, being there to know that when they need help, you know, because sometimes, you know, I'm prepared when I see the hand come up to hit somebody, you know, I'll grab the wrist. Or if you see somebody snatching something from somebody else, right, that's something, or you see your name calling or some of the other kinds of things that go on, then you kind of, you come in and you coach and you do the coaching that you need to do. But I try not to tell them what to do. I mean, I often, you know, well, the tattletale thing, right? They'll come over to you and say, you know, she took my toy. If they're not crying and clearly not really, you know, terribly upset, my response is always, and what did you say to her? Nothing. And I'll say, well, maybe she didn't know you don't like it. You know, right? It gives them the idea that I'm going to go tell them I didn't like that they took it.
Yeah.
When you talk about, Janet, you mentioned sharing. To me, we never required children to share things. It was always a process. Like, we had two swings and there would be 25 kids out there. And, you know, the swings were always a bone of contention. And for a long time, the adults would sit there and make the rules about it, right? And we would say, okay, you get 5 minutes. And what you found out is that at the end of the 5 minutes, or use a timer or whatever you're doing, the kid would hold on to those chains like their life depended on it. You had to pry them off of there. But when we switched to coaching the children to just say, I'm next. Or, you know, the polite way to say it is, when you're done, I'd like a turn. But next is sort of the culture of childhood. To me, that's what we did as kids. It was always like, next. And that was sacred, right? I mean, in my boyhood, growing up, playing in my neighborhood with friends, if you wanted to, you just say next and everybody, darn it, he's next. Well, I'm after you, right? Or same like when you're getting in, like calling shotgun in the car, right? The passenger seat. Shotgun was sacred. If somebody called it, you never could pull rank on somebody who called shotgun. And so letting the kids work it out themselves in their own way. So what we do is we coach them just to say, I'm next. And what we found is that usually once a child says that to somebody and then doesn't put pressure on them by staying there, usually it's like 2 minutes. And then the kid gets done and they say, okay, it's your turn. Deep down inside, we want to cooperate with one another. We want to work together. We want to connect with one another.
We're human. We are wired for human connection. So no, I don't want to give up the fun swing, but when I know that there is somebody else who wants it, I'm driven to cooperate. I'm driven to figure that out. So that's such an important point. We have these very deep instincts that compel us to figure this stuff out.
Now we're driven to cooperate and to work together. I mean, if you've ever read the book Sapiens, the author's name is Harari. I mean, that's his bottom line. You know, we always talk about the human advantages, the opposable thumb or language or something like that. He says, no, we're the most cooperative animal out there. And you think for a second, you think, wait a minute, we don't cooperate at all. Look what we've created. We build buildings. We have road systems. We have transportation. We have cooperated at a level that no other animal can even come close to. We also, I believe, are born not wanting to be told what to do. And so if somebody says, give that swing up, that's when you're not, I'm not going to. But if you're given the choice, like, hey, somebody else wants to use it next, just a piece of information, then we're much more likely to go, oh, they want it next. I, you know, I could be finished.
Yeah.
You know, it gives us, it creates the space for us to do our own thinking for ourselves.
Well, it gives you the opportunity to be like the benevolent, generous person. I know we're talking mostly about preschoolers, parents. This stuff works with tweens and teens too.
It works in our adult relationships too. How about
Nobody likes to be told what to do. Exactly. Nobody ever likes it.
Oh my gosh, Tom, this has been such a great conversation. And I know you are no longer in the classroom on a daily basis, but you are doing a lot of work in the world. Tell us, tell our listeners where they can access what you're doing and learn
more
from you.
Well, I'm still really old-fashioned. I'm still writing a blog. I've been writing it since 2009, and I write almost every day. It's called Teacher Tom. So if people want to see what I'm thinking about, it's just a place for me to reflect on young children and my role and our role in their lives. And you'll find plenty of things to that will make you happy and make you feel good. And you'll find plenty of things that will probably make you mad. And that's good, because we all I care is engaging people in thoughtful dialogue. So, you know, don't get mad at me, get mad at the ideas. Also, we offer, I have a number of courses that people can take. And so if people are interested in the courses, most of them are for parents and or early childhood educators. Mm-hmm. I think we get a lot of parents taking our courses. You can find that at teachertomsworld.com. I also have a couple of books. So if people are interested in having that piece of paper, they can turn the pages. There's two of those, Teacher Tom's first book and Teacher Tom's second book.
Guess
what the third book's going to be called?
I bet it's Teacher Tom's third book. Yes.
Good one. You know.
Patterns. It's patterns.
There's a pattern. Pattern. You're doing your math right now. You've done some pattern recognition. Those are the kind of things we're doing. We also work with a lot of schools and everything out there. So if anybody out there is looking for a little professional development, we work with entire schools and train. And I say we because my wife is my business partner.
Nice.
Providing professional development for educators and also a little parent education here and there.
Mm-hmm. And you're also a keynote speaker. So
I encourage a lot of speaking.
Yeah, I encourage our listeners to connect with you and take a course, because it's not just about the young child. It is really about understanding.
Only going to offer this one more time this year, but we have a course called The Technology of Speaking with Children, and that the subtitle is Speaking with Children So That They Can Think. Technology of Speaking with Children is really a lot about this, how to speak with children so that you're not bossing them around all the time.
Nice.
And you're much more likely to get them on your bandwagon than to have them fighting against you all the time. And this one is really valuable, I think, as a parent. When I learned a lot of this, what I call it is a technology. Mm-hmm. When I learned this, it changed my entire relationship to working with young children.
Mm. And you can find that at teachertomsworld.com, courses link. Tom, thank you so much for your time. I know you are a busy man out there changing the world for the young child, the educators, and the parents who are parenting them.
Thank you so much. It's been such a, I always love talking to you too.
Wisdom for the young child and for all of us as humans. Thanks for joining us. We hope you liked this episode with Teacher Tom. If you do, please share it with a friend. And always thank you for supporting our sponsors. This is the On Boys Parenting Podcast. We are your co-hosts, Janet Allison of BoysAlive.com and Jennifer L.W. Fink of BuildingBoys.net.
Save big on brunch for mom, all in the Kroger app. Get half gallons of delicious Kroger milk for $1.29 each. Then get flavorful Tyson Natural Boneless Chicken Breasts for $2.49 a pound, all with your card and a digital coupon. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.